This is WJBC This Week.
They're doing everything they can to pick up additional routes. They're coming in early. They're staying late.
We hope no one jumps to conclusions. You know, let's let the investigation work its way through.
We're just trying to pick up the pieces where they're left off and drive it forward. And I think we're doing a pretty good job, but it's taking me longer than I wanted to.
We have what money we have, and we'll have to be the best stewards of it we can.
I do not see a circumstance where we will have to resort to layoffs or furlough days.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Bloomington brings state police into an investigation over U.S. Cellular Coliseum's previous management company. We'll hear from one of the people who first started digging into the Coliseum's books, and the man is trying to turn the Coliseum's attention toward the future. A Bloomington alderman challenges Terry Renner's re-election bid as mayor. A Bloomington man fights to get his name on the ballot as an independent running for Congress. Plus, Mothers Against Drunk Driving names a community award in honor of Michael Collins, who was killed by a drunk driver 2 years ago. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Bloomington city officials announced this week they have brought in state police to investigate the operations of the company that had managed U.S. Cellular Coliseum until earlier this year. Blogger Diane Benjamin, who took the city to court last year to gain access to Central Illinois Arena Management's financial records, claims SIAM has shortchanged the city hundreds of thousands of dollars, and she blames city staff for a lack of oversight. Benjamin talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Diane, take us back to when you started on this. And, well, first of all, I'll get your reaction to this investigation. No surprise to you, I'm betting.
It's a surprise that if that's the only thing they're investigating. Because as far as I'm concerned, the city failed in their obligation to taxpayers to supervise the Coliseum management. And I'm talking specifically about concession reports, which you haven't said yet about the lawsuit that I filed over a year ago, to get the concession reports since the city never looked at them. The management agreement spells out clearly what percentage of the concession sales the city is supposed to receive. And if you never look at the reports, how do you know if you're getting paid?
And you have looked at the reports, and I might want to mention for people out here is that when you're looking at financials, you're looking at them through the eyes of being a former CPA, so you understand how this stuff works, right?
Right.
Yeah, and that's a very important key part to this storyline that you've continued to bring. What did you find out when you started, when you finally got the paperwork, because you had filed Freedom of Information Act paperwork many, many times to try to get your hands on this. Once you got your hands on this, what did it tell you?
Going by what the management agreement says and taking their concession reports, the city could have been shorted up to $447,000 in 3 years. Now, I'm sure SIAM would come up with a way to get that number reduced. I don't care if they reduce it to $200,000. It's still $200,000. The city did not get paid what SIAM was supposed to pay them according to the contract.
How did they do that? What do you speculate? How did they do that and not get caught?
Because John Butler set up BMI concessions, and all the concessions went through this private company. Even though the city owned the equipment that the concessions were rang up on, they could have walked over to the Coliseum anytime they wanted and printed off reports. They never did. They never checked. They just took John Butler's word for it that the check that he was writing back to the Coliseum every quarter, every month, whatever he did, was the right amount. And they never took the time to look at the reports and say, hey, we're short. You still owe us X amount of money. Not in the entire 7 years that David Hales has been city manager did he ever look at the reports.
And so when that happens, again, I go back to my original question of how did they do this? How did they hide it? Is it just because there was no oversight from City Hall, is that the key to this whole thing? Because would those numbers have popped up had somebody done their due diligence?
Yeah. Yeah. The city bought the software to track concessions. It's very intricate software that they could have printed all this stuff off on and just said, hey, here's how much concession sales you had for the quarter, and we're showing you only paid us this much. Where's the rest of the money? But nobody did. Nobody cared enough to actually look at it and determine that, yeah, we're being shorted. And in the meantime, the Coliseum had loss after loss after loss after loss. And now we find out that the money probably went to John Butler.
You know, the thing, and that's the speculation, of course. But you're, the paperwork that you got went back only 3 years. And they, of course, had management of the Coliseum for 10 years. Is it possible there's more to still be uncovered in this?
If the reports still exist, I have no idea. The management agreement says that they have to keep the reports for 3 years, and that's why I got 3 years.
Okay. All right. And that, could that be for tax purposes or tax reasons, or just that that was the agreement?
That's just what was in the agreement.
What do you think the Illinois State Police investigation, and again speculating here, but what do you think the Illinois State Police may find once they start doing their investigation?
I don't even know if they're investigating my allegations.
Mm-hmm.
There are other things going on that I can't prove, so I'm not going to talk about.
Sure.
I've heard lots of rumors of what's going on there. And maybe that's what they're investigating, and they're not even looking at the concessions. I have no idea.
That was Diane Benjamin with Dan Swaney. Well, the firm that took over U.S. Cellular Coliseum in April has been cleaning up many issues at the venue in recent months, but is trying to look to the future. Curtis Webb with VenueWorks is the Coliseum's executive director. He talked with WJBC this week.
What involvement have you had to have in this investigation of the past operations and presumably finances for the venue?
You know, not a lot in the way of what's going down. I've just been we've provided the city with MICROS documents, which are food and beverage documents and sales numbers from the past, mostly due to a FOIA request. And then really the only other thing we're involved with is we handed over boxes of documents that were here in the past. That must have been past files, but to be honest with you, I never looked at them. I've kind of got the luxury of just looking forward, not looking back.
Well, that's true. So I would suspect then that when these requests first came in for this information, this was, I suspect, new information to you. This was not something that had your antenna up as far as what had been done in the past.
No, not at all. And, I mean, obviously this is stuff that the city was well aware of prior to my arrival.
Sure. How does this affect your operations going forward? I know that you've had to, as you said, turn over some information.
You know, it really doesn't affect us too much. We're you know, we're really just focusing on being transparent. I think that how it's going to affect us is people are going to ask more and ask for more documentation, and we're fine given that. In fact, it helps you to, you know, make sure everything you do is transparent and open, and everything the city requires from us or the public requires from us in the future, we'll hopefully be able to provide in a quick, timely fashion.
Who was the first that came to you to say, we need some information?
We just had the city attorney ask for MICROS reports, mainly just because of the FOIA request that Diane Benjamin had asked the city of.
Yes, and Diane Benjamin was the one who had filed the FOIA request. Now, did you look at those yourself to see if there was anything that would raise red flags?
No, you know, I don't know enough of the backstory. All that information was just sales, like how many hot dogs and things like that they sold. So I just don't have the time to look at it.
I understand.
Yeah, we're busy moving forward.
Might the city come to you and say, hey, would you look at these to see what your thoughts are, given the fact that you're in the industry?
They may at some point. I haven't been asked that question yet, but that'd be the prerogative. We do whatever the city needs as our client.
As I'm sure you're aware, over the 10 years of the Coliseum and even prior to that, it was a contentious issue in the city. There had been a referendum that the city not go forward with this, an advisory referendum. The city council, of course, went ahead and did it, and there was quite a bit of backlash that probably in some parts of the community still lingers to this day.
Sure.
And you take over having inherited that. How does this further that, or perhaps continue this stigma that some have about the Coliseum and their distaste for what had happened?
Yeah, you know, what all I could prove to folks is moving forward, and when they those naysayers out there, when they ask questions, that we can provide documentation to them, good or bad. I think that's the key, you know. And you know, in any business, you're going to have your good days and your bad days, but the key is always stand tall and continue to be transparent. And when folks ask for certain things, we can get it to them and make sure this never, you know, the negative or the naysayer out there, we can at least turn them into understanding what we're trying to accomplish here. And I'm a pretty open guy in that sense. I try to make sure that, you know, people understand where we're coming from, and they're always welcome to call me. And I try to be just another guy in this community trying to do the right thing.
And has there been anything like this in the past that you've had to deal with from past management or anything of that sort, given the fact that this does happen in the industry where you have management of facilities like this change hands?
Well, I've seen facilities change hands, but never seen, you know, like this. I mean, I'm just, you know, for our standpoint, you know, we're just trying to pick up the pieces where they're left off and drive it forward. And I think we're doing a pretty good job, but it's taken me longer than I wanted to.
And I imagine this might be a part of the reason why. How many employees from the past regime, so to speak, are still at the Coliseum on your staff?
I'm trying to count the number. I don't know if it's obvious. One, about six. So six or seven. So about half their staff is still with us. And, you know, they're really good, hardworking people, very conscientious, and we're lucky to have them.
Are you concerned about the cloud that's hanging over them in regards to this investigation of past practices there?
I'm not. No, these folks are good people. I'm pretty confident they've all done the right thing. And whatever happens with the, you know, investigation, I think these folks are good people and we're doing their jobs all along.
That was Coliseum Director Curtis Webb on WJBC. Mothers Against Drunk Driving has announced its community award was being renamed the Michael Collins Humanity Award in honor of the Normal Native and Illinois State University student who was killed by a drunk driver 2 years ago. The award is given to the individual or group that demonstrates fellowship with others as a result of the sharing of similar attitudes, views, interests, and goals with respect to MAD's mission. Michael Collins' mother, Kelly Collins, talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Your son and in his memory have done a lot to change attitudes about drunk driving. Would you agree with that statement?
I feel absolutely that his legacy has certainly stirred a movement, not only in this community, but as we saw early on in the nation as well. And, you know, one of the things I promised Michael when he was still with us in the hospital, and I do believe that he could hear me, is that I will fight for this cause until I die. And this is what the platform now that God has given us and given me. And, you know, I every single time I am able to wake up in the morning and have a focus, because my husband thought 2 years ago, 2+ years ago, to create this foundation, glorifying God for Michael's life and honoring his legacy through what Michael did as a pay it forward for organ donation. And, you know, it's helped me, give me a reason to get out of bed every morning and to focus on the senseless and preventable crime that drunk driving is. And Michael, and he had a huge impact on the community, and the whole story and so forth was very high profile. And, you know, just given so many of the circumstances that follow, you know, that surrounded it. So, yes, I do believe, you know, the message was already there, you know, don't drink and drive. But I believe that it brought it very close to home in Bloomington Normal, as we've suffered great loss here, not only with Michael's life, but also Lauren Leffler and others who have succumbed to this tragedy.
Yeah, I've had the chance over the past year, and, you know, when Michael died, I really didn't know who he was. And in the past year, I've been able to meet his best friend, other friends of his, someone that was in the car at the time of the wreck who survived. He really touched a lot of people's lives even when he was living.
Absolutely. You know, Michael was... he kind of lit up the room, and you had to know him, and because at first you might think that he was on the quiet side, but it didn't take long for him to get comfortable, and you know I credit that because of his heart. He had a good heart, and you know both my children, I have another son, Jimmy. There is nothing that these two boys wouldn't do for someone, and that's because God has given them each such wonderful hearts, and they're good kids. They know. And so Michael touched people in that way because he was very sensitive to the needs of people around him, and he knew what was right and what was wrong. And so just like that night when they called for a designated driver and, you know, wore seat belts, did everything right, but in the end, what it has taught us is that life is so fragile, and that you know, really, we all walk a thin line between life and death. And never, of course, did we imagine that this would be what our story was. But now that it is, I'm not going to let Michael's passing be for nothing. I told him that, you know, I would fight for this and continue to raise awareness. And unfortunately, just a couple weeks ago, MAD released last year's statistics. And drunk driving has actually, the deaths that have followed from drunk driving has actually increased last year for the first time in a lot of years. And as disturbing as that is, it just fuels my fight even more that we have so much more to do in raising awareness, and not only that, but just the technology that's on the horizon, that MAD continues to fight for legislation, and you know that it's possible that we can bring an end to this senseless and preventable crime.
We're talking with Kelly Collins, whose son Michael Collins was killed in 2014 by a drunk driver. Michael had chosen to make all the right decisions. He was not intoxicated, but the driver who hit him was. Kelly, last year you did an interview with Dan Sweeney, and there's something that you or your husband said that really touched me. And it was a very simple thing, and it was the reminder that you guys don't demonize people who do go out and decide to have a few drinks. You just asked that if people were going to go out and there was the possibility they would drink, that they would make the arrangements beforehand. And you really press that. That touched me personally because I think that's really important. I think that if we are going to trust ourselves while we're intoxicated, we're going to make bad decisions, and those decisions have to be made before we go out for the night.
And that's what we continue to reiterate, is that no one has ever said don't drink. Well, maybe me. We won't get there. But the focus of MAD and all of this is that we know people are going to drink, and so it's never been don't drink. It's just don't drink and drive. And, you know, with everything nowadays, not only just from taxis and but the Uber organization and just the whole thing, you know, it seems like to me, and others have said this as well, that I think the college kids these days have it down better than people who are older than the college group, you know. And for instance, you know, the particular person that murdered Michael was not of college age. And yes, I do know it happens across the board. But it just seems like whenever talking to college kids, They always have that plan in place before they ever go to the party. And that's what so much of it, I think, does, because once you've had a couple drinks, you know, your whole decision process is swayed. And it just takes a split-second decision if you get behind that wheel for everything to change. And, you know, and as I had spoke about earlier around the 4th of July holiday, my father always taught me that these vehicles are basically a 3,000 to 4,000 pound weapon. That's what they essentially are. And if you get behind the wheel drunk or drugged, and we can go as far as texting, I mean, any type of impaired driving, the result, you know, it just echoes through eternity.
That was Kelly Collins, mother of Michael Collins, with Terry James. Today's local news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. A first challenger has emerged in the race for Bloomington mayor. 3 weeks after Terry Renner announced plans to seek a second term as mayor, Diane Howman, who Renner nominated for the city council 2 years ago, announced she is going to seek the top spot at City Hall. Howman talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
There must be some aspect of the way he's running the city that you think you can do a better job. Well, you just want to play lightning round? I'll just throw some things at you.
His long-term
plan. I mean, you guys just came out with that five-year plan. Streets, infrastructure, your thoughts on that?
Well, we're still working on that. We've just heard two parts of that. We'll be introduced to other aspects over the next, through March, sorry, so another 6 months. Each month a different department is coming forth with what they need. We already know what some of the things are there because there is a five-year streets and sidewalk plan. We're in debt, or we will, I shouldn't say, I'm sorry, well, we are in debt, but we've got almost $400 million worth of needs. Mm-hmm. And if you own a house, oftentimes you put money away because you know that eventually the water heater is going to need to be replaced or the roof only has a 20-year, 25-year warranty. We haven't been so good about that, and so we're behind. And it's going to take some creativity, and it's going to take a while to get caught up because even if we had all the money, there's no way we could do every street in one season, A, for manpower, and B, just for the materials. So it'll be a 10 to 15 years before we see some of the things that are being done.
But do you like the plan that has been presented so far?
It's necessary, yes.
Okay.
I do.
So you don't differ with the mayor on that at all?
Not yet.
All right. How about
we have, because we don't know how we're going to finance this yet. How we're going to pay for this?
Bonds. I think he brought it up yesterday.
Yeah.
You've got some bonds that are expiring, and you're going to borrow more to.
That's part of it. But you know, with $400 million, I don't know for sure that bonds is going to cover it all.
Okay. He's big on a hotel downtown. Do you think it's necessary?
I think a hotel is part of a downtown strategy or vision. My concern is I don't feel like we have a downtown vision, what we want our downtown to look like, feel like, taste like, smell like. I mean, we've got great opportunities. We've got that front and center building that's in play. The Pantograph building, I think, is now in play. C2 East. There's the old school on Washington Street. There's the Warehouse District, the Electrolux building. I mean, there's a number of different areas that we could look at.
Do you have any ideas? What you'd like to see? What's your vision of downtown Bloomington?
Well, okay, Dear Santa, I'd like to see a large family-friendly green space in the downtown area that's got a stage that could be part of it could be flooded in the winter for ice skating, okay? Dog park. I'd like to see more benches downtown for people to sit on, you know, if they're walking around downtown, want to just sit and watch the people go by. We've got, you know, a few of those, but I don't think enough of those. A hotel would certainly, you know, fit into that. A year-round farmer's market area, like they have in Dayton, the Fifth Street Market. Steak and Shake. I mean, they're, you know, I just, I would, I want to, I would like our downtown to have something for everyone, so that the folks that live on the east side of Veterans Parkway will come down as well as everybody else.
Why is it important that they come downtown? I mean, we've got them, you know, when it comes to shopping and retail, we've got the malls and the big box stores.
Yeah.
What do you tell people that say, we are wasting our money trying to revitalize downtown? We've been trying it for years and years and years. You still have people that think that the arena was a big waste of money. The BCPA, money poured into that, they think it's a waste. Those people are never going to be happy, I don't think. But there are people out there that sit there and think, we don't need to be spending money on downtown. We're fine.
People don't go to the mall to socialize. They go to the mall to shop. If you're looking for a place if you're working downtown, to stay downtown after work, go to a movie, go shopping. We do have entertainment. We've got the Castle Theater and as you mentioned, the BCPA and the Coliseum. We need more to attract people and keep people. And part of this is if we're going to attract or keep the graduating college students around, they want a downtown atmosphere.
But do you spend $1 million on an ice skating rink, or do you spend $1 million on resurfacing a mile of road?
Yes. And I don't mean to be flip about that. If we're attracting people and enlarging our tax base, people are here, whether they rent or buy a home, they're going to be buying food, they're going to be buying clothes, cars, et cetera. Those are all things that add to our tax base.
Well, I'm listening to you, and I don't think Terry Renner would have a – I'm trying to find where you differ, where you feel he has not stepped up to the plate and you could do a better job.
I'm going to go back to downtown. A hotel is part of downtown, but how does that fit into a bigger plan? I have not seen a bigger plan. We've got the, we have the,
Coliseum?
The plan that
the South Block?
Regional Planning Commission put together to bring it on Bloomington. We've got a downtown plan that we spent, I think, $400,000 on that's sitting on a shelf. We've got the BN Advantage information. We've done nothing to put those three things together and say, okay, we've got good information, good ideas. Where are we going to go first?
What's your thought on consultants? Do we need a consultant for everything?
Not for everything.
Do you think we use consultants too often? Spend too much on consultants?
We tend to be a little risk averse, and so using consultants sometimes folks feel that there's a buffer then between decisions and the staff or the council. I think we do use consultants sometimes well. Stephen Friedman and his group gave us some good information about hotels, what to look for, how to vet potential developers. But in defense of the staff, sometimes they either don't have the time or don't have the expertise on staff to do certain things.
All right. If you were elected mayor, would you keep the city manager?
That is the will of the city council. Our city manager is the only employee that the city council has. And if the majority of the city council want to keep Mr. Hales, he stays.
Lightning round. Budget task force. Remember the budget task force studied ways to close the $7 million deficit? Do you think that was a waste of time?
I think the concept was good. I'm not sure it was executed properly. We had citizens that spent hours on that task force, and we took none of their suggestions.
All right. Tax hikes. We had a lot of tax hikes so far as with Mayor Renner at the helm, and I imagine you voted for a lot of these. Gasoline sales tax?
Before me.
It was before you, was it?
Yeah.
The amusement tax?
Before me.
Really?
Yeah.
Sharing sales tax in Normal.
Your thought on that? I was disappointed, Scott, that we didn't at least talk about it. When we met as a committee of the whole, we voted down even talking to Normal. And even if we chose not to share sales tax with Normal, other things may have come out of that discussion, other ways that we could work with Normal. And I was disappointed that we chose not to go forward with that.
Hindsight being 2020, would you have voted yes for an increase in the amusement tax? for example.
Depending on what they were going to, if it was dedicated, yeah.
Gasoline tax for roads.
For roads, yeah.
You would.
Yeah.
So, final question. The biggest difference, why should I vote for you over Terry Renner?
Here, I'm just going to share with you how I would have approached a couple things that have been done. The mayor is looking at shrinking the liquor commission. I would expand the liquor commission. I would include a student because we have a number of students that come into our downtown Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights. If we consider that a quote problem unquote, the students should be a student should be represented on the liquor commission, and I would include a somebody who has been in the liquor industry but is no longer in the liquor industry, so that there's some real world information about that. So I'd be expanding that. I'd be looking at trying to bring in a more diverse group to sit on our boards and commissions to get information out to let people know when there are vacancies so that we're not taking the one applicant that has put in the papers for it, but actually have a broader pool and include the council on who should be on the boards and commissions.
That was Bloomington Alderwoman and mayoral candidate Diana Hellman with Scott Laughlin. Emergency room doctor David Gill of Bloomington isn't giving up hope that he can get his name on the ballot for the November election in his bid to unseat Congressman Rodney Davis. Gill is seeking to run as an independent against Davis and Democrat Mark Wicklund. Gill is asking a federal appeals court to reconsider its decision to temporarily halt a lower court's order that his name should appear on the November ballot. This after a federal judge had ruled that Gill's name should appear on the ballot. Gill claims the number of signatures he must obtain is unfair and unreasonable. It's about 13 times what Republican and Democratic candidates must submit. Gill talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
So where do you go from here?
Right. Where the real battle is taking place is at the Court of Appeals in Chicago. We won in federal court on August 25th. I was in court. I spoke to you that day on August 24th.
Mm-hmm.
We were in court all that afternoon. And it's less than a day later, at noon the next day, Judge Myerscough put out her 26-page opinion. And if you read that in detail, you know, it's a very decisive victory in which she declared that we have a strong likelihood of winning this lawsuit. And so she issued a preliminary injunction saying that somebody that collects 8,600 signatures, as I have ballot signatures, should be on the ballot. And the next day, August 26th, Attorney General Lisa Madigan filed an appeal of that up at the Court of Appeals. And at the same time, she filed a motion asking the Court of Appeals to stay Judge Myerscough's order, which means, you know, put the brakes on her preliminary injunction. And so they spent 2 weeks scratching their heads about that. And then last Friday, 2 weeks to the day, they put out a one-sentence ruling. They don't have to justify anything. They just put out a one-sentence ruling saying the stay is granted, and which effectively would take me off the ballot for now. And what we've done in response yesterday, we filed a motion asking the entire appellate court to vacate that stay. It was a three-judge panel that put that sentence out last Friday, and we believe that they issued that in grave error, and we're asking the entire nine-judge panel, or the entire nine-judge court up there to review that, and we're asking them to agree with Judge Myerscough.
The only argument that I have seen for you not being on the ballot, I mean, first of all, they think you should have gotten the over 10,000 signatures, but the other one is that you could cause voter confusion. But otherwise, I mean, what do you think's going on here?
Well, I think it's, you know, as I've said for a long, long time, that it's a rigged system, Terry. And they don't want anybody breaking up their system, so to speak. You know, part of the reason, the main reason I'm running as an independent is that I don't believe that either major party has been looking out for the well-being of the vast majority of us here in middle America, if you will. And I think that we're seeing that. They don't want anybody standing up for ordinary Americans, and they feel threatened that their two-party oligarchy, as it were, would crumble a wee bit if this one outspoken position had a path to Washington, D.C.
If you don't get on the ballot this time, will you run again? And obviously, since you got 8,500 signatures, would you run as a Democrat so you only have to get 740?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that I'm going to persist with the lawsuit because it's a winning case, and it's something that will drag on for many months, if not a year or two. But ultimately, it's something that's very important to me as far as allowing democracy to thrive in our country. Because when we ultimately win this lawsuit, you know, separate and apart from the preliminary injunction and my presence on a ballot this year, when we win that lawsuit, that's going to knock down a big, heavy door that's been standing in the way of a lot of independents and Constitution Party and Green Party and libertarians from having ready access to the ballot, which I think we really need in this country. So I'll definitely continue with the lawsuit. I definitely still have a fire in my belly, so to speak. I don't like seeing people get the short end of the stick, and most of us have been on that end of things for a while. So I'm not sure, you know, just what I'll do, but yeah, I'm very hopeful that we can still get this thing turned around. And if it doesn't happen at the Court of Appeals this week, there is a court higher than that that oversees that, and that's the Supreme Court. Justice Elena Kagan oversees the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and we have the opportunity to take the thing to her if we're not getting a satisfactory answer this week.
At the end of the day, there has to come a time where everybody has to print their ballots. What's the deadline here?
You know, it's fuzzy. It's written in law that they have to have the ballots in the mail on September 23rd, which is a week from this Friday, so, 10 days from now, to overseas military. And yet it's also written in that law that if there's litigation pending, that September 23 doesn't necessarily stick. So, but obviously it's going late in the day, so to speak, and, you know, we're running up against the clock. That's why we may have the opportunity to approach the Supreme Court because of the time element involved.
Well, I always respect somebody who's fighting for what they think is right, and I know that's what you're trying to do. In fact, you've told me before that even if it's not you this time, that you would like to change the system for others in the future.
Yeah, I think it's very important. I think, you know, we've had 30 or 40 years of most Americans having some element of difficulty economically, whether it be health care or retirement or job security or the ability to go to college. And there's a reason for that. These guys have been working for Wall Street banks and big corporations for a long time, both major parties. And we need to take steps to correct that.
That was independent congressional candidate David Gill with Terry James. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. The struggles Unit 5 is experiencing with its transportation are taking a toll on bus drivers. The drivers are employed by First Student. AFSCME Union Representative Renee Kessler says the drivers are stressed out.
They're doing everything they can to pick up additional routes. They're coming in early. They're staying late. And they're doing whatever they can, but they also get sick. They also have children. They also have other jobs, a lot of them.
Parents and students have been frustrated by late and overcrowded buses for weeks. Kessler says entering into a fair contract with the company can help alleviate some of the pressure put on drivers. The message from Illinois State University President Larry Dietz during his annual State of the University address was much the same as last year. ISU is strong and stable. This despite all the problems presented at the state level. Dietz says ISU will continue to put students first.
And again, I do not see a circumstance where we will have to resort to layoffs or furlough days, something that has already happened and will continue to happen, in my estimation, at many other colleges and universities throughout the state.
Dietz says he plans to push for a modest mid-year salary increase for faculty and staff. And the state's flagship university is on the hook for $3 million in addition to wages because of a change to federal wage laws. Starting in December, anyone making an annual salary less than $47,000 will be eligible for overtime under new rules from the U.S. Department of Labor. University spokeswoman Robin Kaler says the money will have to come out of their current budgets and grant reserves.
We have what money we have, and
we'll have to be the best stewards of it we can, as we always try to be.
Normal's Historic Preservation Commission has voted against allowing the demolition of the Illinois Soldiers and Sailors Children's School Administration Building in Normal. The vote means the town council has 30 days to stop the demolition, or the building will take it down, and City Manager Mark Peterson is recommending the building be demolished. Town Planner Mercy Davison says the building has been vacant for decades.
Back in 2008, the town worked with the owner to put out a request for proposals, and we distributed it statewide to try to find someone to rehabilitate the building. So that was one effort I was part of, where we actually tried to find an owner.
Davison says the owner of the building has made an effort to find a new developer. If the demolition goes forward, the town will be paying the owner for the cost of raising the building. But Peterson says the infirmary building next door will be used in part as an art gallery. And Bloomington City Manager David Hale says there's no timeline for how long the state police investigation into U.S. Cellular Coliseum's operations could take. The Coliseum's former management company, Central Illinois Arena Management, is the target of a probe stemming from the 10 years when it ran the Coliseum.
We hope no one jumps to conclusions. You know, let's let the investigation work its way through.
Hales tells WJBC the Coliseum's accounts are audited every year, but the city dove deeper into the books during the management transition last spring. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Normal's Town Council will consider a plan for construction of a new apartment complex near Heartland Community College. Also Monday, Bloomington's City Council will meet as a committee of the whole to discuss a long-term road improvement plan. On Tuesday, State Senator Chapin Rose will host a state budget town hall meeting at Tri-Valley Middle School in Downs. Also Tuesday, Heartland Community College will adopt an annual budget. And Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan will have a joint effort for its new Peace Corps Prep Certificate program. On Thursday, Bloomington will hold a public meeting to discuss a proposed extension of Hamilton Road. And downtown Bloomington stakeholders will host a workshop to discuss long-range plans for the city's downtown business district. And on Saturday, Illinois State will open Missouri Valley Football Conference play at Indiana State. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Starr.